Most European leaders, especially those ones that went, are all obviously vassals to America. They go cap in hand to see daddy. Mark Rutte knew.
Actually used the term.
He's daddy. And yes, daddy, what do you want, daddy? And that kind of stuff, you know. And it's a bit embarrassing in a certain sense for them because, although it's not really, I mean, it's good that it's been shown in public because that's the kind of thing that had to go on, that went on before under Biden and previous administrations. They knew
this was how it is.
That they were the low man in the totem pole kind of thing. But it was, you know, they were treated with a bit more respect, I suppose. You know, they pretended, the Americans would have pretended, at least officially, they wouldn't have brought it out. They wouldn't have aired that kind of laundry in public. But Trump has no problem doing that because Trump likes to appear as the main decider, right? He's the top dog, he's daddy. And he likes the whole world to know that. Previous administrations didn't care for that kind of showmanship, and it was actually anathema to the general way that the Western world has been run before, which is all done in secret, and you do it, you know, you present all a common face to the population and stuff. You don't show what goes on behind the scenes. You know, it's embarrassing, it's lowbrow, it's not, we're all intellectuals, you know. Whereas Trump isn't necessarily, he doesn't subscribe to that, and he likes to take every opportunity to show that he's top dog, daddy. Come on, children. So, you know, so it's about, it's called a cult of personality, but, and yeah, I'd say in that respect, there's a cult of personality around Trump, and it has one member, and that's Trump himself. He is his greatest fan. He is his own dear leader. A lot of MAGA people see him to one extent or another like that, but he absolutely. I mean, I don't think in the way that Kim Jong Un is presented, you know, to whatever extent those people in North Korea actually see him as dear leader and love him. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know.
It could well be. There's no MAGA members who see Trump in that way. They're not that devoted to him. Some of them maybe are, like you, but. But not most of them. You know, they just see him as, look, he's going to do what we want him to do. He's our president, that's the kind of thing. But in terms of the way the North Koreans treat Kim Jong-un, he's Trump treats himself like that.
Yeah.
He basically worships that. If there was a giant statue of Trump somewhere in gold leaf, you know, Trump would go and pay homage to it. Because he refers to himself in the third person. He talks about Trump. Trump did this and Trump did that.
Yeah.
It's like he can't dissociate himself from himself and see how awesome he is from a distance. You know, almost literally, you know. He steps outside of his own body, looks at himself and says, wow, you are the best.
I think he has said on the record he would like to be worshipped like Kim Jong-un.
Well, he's not the only one. That's the thing as well, is that of
he's
course,
honest though.
Yeah, exactly. He's honest. And that's the one thing you can say about Trump is that he can't hold his tongue. He doesn't stand on ceremony. He doesn't care for airs and graces and that kind of stuff. He likes just...
Or implying nuance.
No, he's meaning. Just straight up and he tells it like he sees it, which is good because you get to see a lot more than you did in the past when they would basically just lie to you all the time. And there are, you know, a bunch of kiddie fiddlers behind the scenes and then come out and, you know, go to mass or something like that, you know. So you wouldn't really... I don't think Trump is that kind of person. Anyway, so they all go to the White House, cap in hand, yes, daddy. And they're forced into these positions. Like, you can see Trump is actually for, he could have actually met them, but he didn't bother his ass. He had the chief of protocol, I think her name is, or her title is. She met them.
Crowley.
At the White House and brought them in. The only one he actually met was Zelensky. Trump actually personally met Zelensky as he arrived at the White House, but the others were all chief of protocol, just bring those people in. sit them outside, even though that was a fake picture of them all sitting outside. There is one of them in the actual Oval Office, all sitting around in a circle saying, Trump's like, now listen up, children. Here's what we're going
to
do.
We have it here.
Now, listen, children, here's what we're going to do.
Beautiful picture.
Yeah.
Trump's view and then...
So Daddy's telling them what's going on. And Zelensky's there and they're all...
A situation map of Ukraine. Yeah.
And they're all pretending like, yes, we're all part of the top team here, you know what I mean? But obviously that's like the boss telling you all what has to happen, you know?
Yeah.
And of course the EU was a project when it was created of the Americans, basically. The European Union was very definitely a project of the Americans in order to keep Europe together. Like they anticipated the fall of the Soviet Union. They didn't want things to fall apart and it all to be dispersed and countries in Europe to go east. I mean, it's not even go east. It's like be part of Eurasia. You know, America always had a problem with holding on to Europe, whatever amount of Europe it wanted, Western Europe, because it's not part of America. It's separated by 3,000 miles of Atlantic Ocean. And it's part of a contiguous landmass with Russia and the Middle East and all that kind of stuff. So
pipelines, rail network, communications were always going to...
Yeah. So in order to not, after the fall of the Soviet Union and, you know, things opening up after that, they were worried about losing Europe. So, well, before that, during the actual Cold War, they hatched this plan for a European Union that would be based on, you know, Western, liberal, neoliberal, rules-based international order, golden billion ideology, and, you know, draw the map around it of as much as possible. Of course, at the time, they were limited to the Western Europe because it was still Eastern Europe was still under the part of the, you know, they were Soviet under the Soviet Union, basically the Eastern European countries. Anyway, so this is just a legacy of that. You know what I mean? I mean, that's the thing. People look at this today and they think they have a very short kind of time span or attention span or awareness of the situation. They go, "Oh, what happened to Europe by our leader being such you know." Such cucks to Trump and America and stuff. Like, dude, it's been that way for a very long time. I mean, wake up, look at the inception of the European Union, you know. Last independent European leader was Charles de Gaulle.
Yeah.
Of France. Well, maybe there's a few. They tried, but it was too late afterwards. Anyway, so it's totally normal that they'd be over there, you know, having to, you know, pay homage to Trump. Because they've been doing it for quite a long time. To other presidents, but Trump is now forcing them to do it in this somewhat embarrassing way because that's who Trump is, and he likes to show off that this is making America great again. Look, Trump's like, if we've got vassals, right? If we're the undisputed leader of the world, then I want everybody to know it. I'm gonna use that. I'm gonna toot my own horn here. So who's our vassals again? What, UK, Germany, France? And the rest of them, get them over here. Get them to crawl up to me on their knees, kiss my feet,
and beg for security.
And beg guarantee. For security, because that's what they're actually doing. But I want it on camera.
Yeah.
So the whole world knows who we are and who I am.
This is what how it works.
And this is America being great. Of course, a great country has vassals, right? Yeah. People come bringing gifts.
Yeah,
to the great leader.
One of his gripes. During the 4 years of Biden, that nobody shows him any respect. Nobody exactly. internationally shows him any respect.
Right.
They don't respect him. Vote for me, they'll respect me.
Yeah.
That was literally, yeah.
But that was only a facade because obviously Biden and other presidents aren't the people that you actually go and talk to, right? You can go and talk to them, but they're not the ones who make the decisions. It's deep staters, career bureaucrats and stuff. Behind the scenes, obviously Europeans showed a lot of respect to those people because they knew they were the movers and shakers. They didn't really care much about the president, you know. So anyway, it's hard to know exactly what was going on, but you had them. This was after Alaska. What was Alaska? Alaska was Trump. It's hard not to conclude that Trump has basically decided or is saying behind the scenes to Putin, look, I'm going to say a bunch of things and I'm going to be disappointed in you. I'm not going to be happy. I'm going to say some maybe threatening or, you know, harsh things or whatever, but you got to, you know, understand that that's what I have to say and that in reality what's going to happen here is that you go ahead and
annex
and go ahead and proceed with the proceed with the war, win the war militarily, and kind of quote unquote put me in a position, or not put me, but put all of us in a position where we have to accept the fact that, you know, create facts on the ground so you make my job easier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do more. Get to the point where it's indisputable and there's no option for saying, oh no, we can keep fighting, we have to keep fighting. And that will make Trump's job easier of selling and convincing these other people that it should be let go, it should be brought to an end, and there should be a, Russia should get the territory that it's taken, and whatever makes sense, we can work out a deal, some compromises here and there, whatever, but Russia's going to demand basically all of Donetsk, all of the Donbass. They're even willing to let go of some of Zaporizhia and Kherson, the other two to the south, and freeze it along the front lines, and then a few other details, and there you go. And there'll be security guarantees. I mean, he trusts that Putin will not invade anymore. It'll all stabilize. Well, because Trump wants stability, right? At least in that area, right? He wants to move on to other more pressing issues. So he wants to wrap that up. So, and he sees opportunity, economic opportunity, and how Russia and America can work together and all that kind of stuff. But he has to take into consideration the Europeans' concerns, let's say, and has to make them feel. Because the security guarantees aren't just for Ukraine. The security guarantees are for Europe.
Oh, yeah.
Right. People keep talking about security guarantees for Ukraine. No, the Europeans are actually over there asking for security guarantees for themselves.
It's their own skin completely. At this point, it's been said 100 times. So apparently they are all as one on this, from Brussels to Berlin to Kyiv. Ukraine is Europe's military force against Russia.
Right.
What they're thinking of, they seem to be okay with the de facto reality that Russia has these four provinces. They won them in a fair fight. But it's the rest of Ukraine. Macron's idea of a Grande Armée presence of some kind in the rest of Ukraine is still uppermost in their mind. And we heard Starmer and Macron put forward this case again in DC with Trump, and Trump was kind of like yes and no to both. Well, we'll see, kind of stuff, ambiguous. But again, their interpretation of what comes next is some kind of European military presence in the rest of the country, which includes what they called an Article 5 like clause. In other words, Ukraine won't be in NATO legally de jure, therefore we give Russia one of its core three conditions. Okay, mm-hmm. It satisfies them. Land is one issue. That's the NATO neutral membership of Ukraine. But we're angling to create the conditions where it is as if they are de facto in mm-hmm. NATO, because we're going to continue arming them with mm-hmm. American weapons. We're going to bilk the European taxpayer for.
Right.
So they seem to leave content that their ideas sat well with Trump. You know what I mean? They didn't come back ashen-faced like, oh my God, we live in a totally different world to how Trump sees this going forwards. Mm-hmm. They seem to leave Washington thinking, oh, okay, our future for Ukraine and Europe and its role as a military bulwark against Russia remains intact.
Yeah, that's all they want.
But meanwhile, in Russia, it's like, no, it remains, there's no chance in hell their position officially that you're going to have European troops.
No.
Well, that's the rest of Ukraine.
But that's not going to happen.
That impasse is like...
What the Europeans want, and people don't know why the Europeans fear Russia, the European clique, not all of them, obviously, but the ones that, for example, visited Washington and stuff, why they fear Russia, why they're so anti-Russia and stuff like that. Number one, they only think short-term, and only for the short-term survival, the individuals. They want to be in power, whether or not they're actually in power. They want their ideology and their clique of people to rule in the specific countries in Europe, which are the major countries, which then have an influence, a controlling influence on the rest of the other countries that may not be ideologically aligned with them, but they can keep them in check. So Macron, Starmer, von der Leyen as head of the EU, Merz in Germany, they're all on board. Now the big countries, Maloney to a large extent, and they're interested in their own survival, their own political survival. It's very useful, as we know, or everybody should know by now, for that those kind of people who don't really have a proper mandate from the people. The main thing that they rely on to keep themselves in power is an external threat.
Yeah.
So, for example, terrorism was very useful, Muslim terrorism, but now Russia is the boogeyman du jour, and that has to keep going. We need to keep Russia as an enemy into the future, at least short term, for our survival. So we can, you know, that's what we've staked our claim to as the leaders of these countries and the group, not just those individuals, but the people around them. So if they didn't have that threat, if relationship with Russia was normalized, no more threat from Russia, you can't use that, very quickly they would be kicked out of power, basically. They wouldn't win another mandate. And there's also the fear that if Russia becomes too strong and too influential, as was the case, it was going that direction with Russia, particularly with energy reserves, for example, Russian gas supplying most of Europe, Europe being very dependent, increasingly dependent on Russian gas and stuff. Why did they kick that up and say, oh, it's not good to rely on one country, which is bullshit, you know what I mean? It's like, they had other supplies as well, but if you've got cheap, reliable gas supply from a major country that has like more or less an endless supply of gas, you're an idiot to not just run with that, right? So why do you go, oh, we have to cut that off, let's blow up Nord Stream 1, let's cut off all Russian gas, let's shoot ourselves in the foot while we're at it. Mm-hmm. Because ideologically they fear, they don't like Russia because that's where it comes down to ideology. They're not on the same page as Russia and the Russian government and the Russian mentality ideologically, and they don't want that infiltration into Europe because then they would also lose their jobs. They would no longer be... electable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you have to understand, if Russia becomes, as it was, if Russia becomes a very influential country for economically first and foremost, and then by implication or by definition, diplomatically and politically, you're talking about having a shared ideology, ultimately. You know what I mean? You can't be very opposed, completely diametrically opposed ideologically and do business with...
You'll end up with a situation where the Chancellor of Germany, like Schroeder after
exactly.
Iraq
that,
war,
that kind of guy.
Is so in sync with Moscow, he retires to be on the board of Gazprom.
Right, exactly. So that would spread throughout Europe, and you would basically have most European countries through that knock-on effect from economics through to politics, etc. You would have a change in ideology, and all these people who in power in Europe today would no longer be able to do business, let's say, with Russia, or they would have to change their ideology, and they don't want to do that. And or you would have other types of people who have a similar ideology to the Russians becoming the political leaders in European countries. So they see it as a sea change. You know, it's probably something they feel more than have actually planned out.
A regime change. Regime in the sense of the general intellectual climate of the country.
And what it comes down to is domination. Like we said, they're vassals of Europe, of America, of their US vassals. They're picked, a lot of them are chosen and facilitated and funded, etc., into power in Europe by the Americans. So
it also explains the in your face contradiction.
But that's why they're having a problem with Russia, with Putin as well, or not Putin, with Trump, because he seems to be changing the ideology. If you know what I mean, that's the big issue behind all this. Like, because these European leaders are American vassals. And chosen, picked ideologically on the same page as the Americans, and their ideology is world domination. Russia's ideology is multipolarity, sharing, everybody gets a piece of pie, America, and by extension, their European vassals, or we run the world.
Yeah, dominance hierarchy.
Right. And that's another fundamental, that's part of the ideological difference between these people and Russia, and that's why they don't like Russia. And that goes back a long time, actually, but in one way or another. But they're having a problem with Trump because Trump seems to be moving away from that idea of, at least Trump's moving away from the idea of American dominance in the kind of naked imperialistic way that it was run before under the neoliberals, you know, going back multiple decades in the US, you know, and the Europeans were on board with that. And now Trump's changing that, where it's like, well, we know about it, right? It's
being the
policeman of the world, protecting everybody. Trump's like, yeah, look, I want to run the, well, I still want America to be great and to have, you know, be the greatest country in the world and all that kind of stuff, but I just don't agree with the way that you're going about it. And the rest of them are like, hang on a minute, that means, it smells a lot like you're going to cut us loose.
It smells a lot like Putin.
And
that's what they've been charging you with since 2016. It smells to us like you're like Putin.
Not just like Putin, and but it smells to us like it's almost like you're going towards multipolarity in a certain sense.
Yeah.
We know that Marco Rubio mentioned multipolarity, that they're becoming, that they're Americans, this administration anyway under Trump, are being more realistic about the nature of the world and how the future of the world looks like, and it looks like some version of multipolarity. And in that scenario, the Europeans lose their positions because they basically maintained their positions and their wealth, etc., on hanging on to the coattails of America as this aggressive imperial power, global hegemon. If that's no longer the case, then we'd by definition lose. You know, we're going to have to fight for ourselves. I mean, you're really going to cut us loose, and how are we going to?
We're going to have to turn into Europe first. But the question hanging over the entirety of Europe is, who is that?
Right.
Yeah. In other words, who is our Hitler? That's what no one wants to say out loud. But
yeah, but there is no Hitler in Europe.
Or there can't Bonaparte, if you want to go back further. But
there can't be, because there's no cohesiveness of the ideology they pushed, which was anathema to the actual, you know, the will or the political perspective and social and cultural perspective of the majority of people in Europe. These people like Macron and Stormer and all those people are doing exactly the opposite of what the ordinary people in Europe want. So the majority of people in Europe are not going to vote for any of them if they were chosen to be. None of those could be the new Napoleon, because none of them represent the will of the European people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So they have to hold on to power in whatever way they can. Yeah,
it's existential for them, because we Euro-globalists either stay united and retain our control by rigging the elections if we have to, or we're going to be picked off one by one by Putin, by Russian influence, or by the US on the Western side, Eastern side. We're just going to be picked off.
Well, they're all picked off already by America, but we're going to be lost to... We could be lost to the East, to Russia, etc., and those influences. And the problem is that in Europe, there's already several European countries who are already in that camp. They're already willing, and able to pivot east towards at least to Russia and China, and to restore relations and have a more Eurasian integration perspective.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the hounds. The wolves are at the door, you know, already within Europe, not even at the door, they're inside the building. And the big four, whatever you want to call them, four or five European countries have to, under the stewardship of these shitfabrians, have to double down. And they're just flailing, really. They don't know exactly what they're very afraid, basically. They don't know what the future holds for them, you know. So they're just getting desperate, you know. And the only thing they see is their own personal power, like I said. And one of the main things that motivates them is having an external enemy, because that's what ensures them. They think that's what ensures them renewed success at the polling station.
These crazy bastards, though. I think things would just work out in some surprising and fine ways if they would just yield power.
Mm.
Look at Orban, Fico. Hungary's doing fine. It's prepared to pivot east, but it's still committed to the West. It's still writing love notes to Donald Trump. And the situation, the Yukis keep striking this pipeline that remains going through Ukraine, and the Druzhba pipeline that is over 50% of Hungary's energy base.
Mm-hmm.
It's oil anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Goes to this one. Last week, the Yukis struck it for the third time.
And you know who?
Inside Russia.
You know who really?
With HIMARS.
You know who really struck it? Europeans.
Well, HIMARS, as we learned from those deep dives and investigative reports by the New York Times and the Washington Post, rely entirely on US ISR, satellite surveillance. Mm-hmm. So, and then Orban writes a letter to Washington, says, please, Donald, you know, speak up for our, this is a terrible attack against our energy dependence. And Donald replies back, and the foreign minister of Hungary posted on his X feed a handwritten note. This is terrible. They're bad guys. We'll totally support you. You're a great man, Victor. Mm. Yeah, but it's HIMARS. Yes. The U.S. fucking did that, basically. The U.S. structure, not Trump. Yeah. It happened without him. Right. It happened because of the deep state structure. Right. But
he wants to hold on to Europe and wants to screw over Hungary because as a thorn in the European.
And Brussels basically told him to go hang.
Yeah.
He said, oh, that's unfortunate.
But that's Europe.
Not that we give a damn.
That's the American / Europeans doing that to Hungary by using Ukraine's hand. So, so what's the future? What future hold? The future hold? I don't know. One thing is, I mean, there's one that I've been thinking about this week because it came out last week, I think, or even before that. I don't know, but I saw it not so long ago about the there's a poll, Gallup poll in Ukraine that showed support for
that's damning. They try to keep it quiet, but it was
Gallup. Yeah, you can't find it, actually. You look, Paul, you look...
I did.
You look up Ukraine. You can't find it, but if you do a normal like Google search or even, you know, search engine search for...
No.
Just standard...
it's being censored on
phrases like
news.
Ukraine, war, public poll, or even more...
Gallup, if you add the name of the...
It basically, it's an example of censorship, but this is... it. Here, actually, I don't know what...
I only found it as a screenshot by...
Yeah, there's one article I found, Ukraine support for war, and this, but it's from, I think it's from late last month, maybe, so the last couple of weeks. But anyway, it's, so 2025 Gallup poll found that 69% of Ukrainians support peace talks to end the conflict as soon as possible. Stark reversal from 2022 when 73% favored fighting until victory and 52% of those favoring negotiations are open to territorial concessions. So,
naturally, because 52% of Ukrainians are basically Russians.
Yeah. Well, maybe not, but...
Well, no. They would have voted consistently as the...
Yeah, maybe, but I think, I mean, we'll get into that as well about the toll of the war on Ukraine that and the Ukrainian people has been felt really... You know, significantly, it's getting worse as time goes on, you know, so people at least have a bit of sense, you know, people who responded to this poll at least have a bit of sense. So anyway, the point being that Zelensky, this stands in stark contrast. So you have 69%, so almost 70% of Ukrainians want an end to the war and are happy with...
scroll down so we can see the chart.
There's no chart. It's just a headline. Anyway... Just a chart. Like, so, anyway, there's a clear, serious, you know, serious division between the will of the majority of the Ukrainian people and what Zelensky's saying, because they're saying basically end the war, give Russia territory that it has taken, whatever, work it out one way or another. We just want an end to this war. 70%. And Zelensky is like, no, I'm going to keep going. And the Europeans are saying, yeah. Zelensky's going to keep fighting.
To the last Ukrainian.
Fuck the will of the Ukrainian people. Now, if that continues, and so there's a relatively recent poll, we don't know how long, obviously this has been going on over the past couple of years or whatever, but it's reaching this level now, and it'll probably get worse as things continue. And you notice also that the Russians have been pushing in that direction as well, of trying to, like in the past few months, they've started attacking the recruitment centres in Ukraine.
Mm.
And... it's interesting how Russia does that. The Russians obviously have an awareness of, or have, you know, probably have different ways of getting a feel for the public sentiment in Ukraine, and they respond
to amplify or provoke or capitalize on it.
Based on that. They take action based on that, and then they do different things to capitalize on or to push it in that direction, you know. But they know what's happening organically anyway, because people get tired of war. There's war fatigue after, you know, 3.5 years and a lot of deaths, which we'll talk about in a minute. And they have a government who is responding to those people, 70% of the population, by saying, fuck you. We're going to keep fighting. And what that means is we're going to keep sending your sons to die.
And because of the war, you're not getting elections because I declared martial law. Right. So
as long as the war continues, Ukraine, as Zelensky stays in power, and the Europeans are happy with that, and the Europeans get to keep Russia as a boogeyman and keep fighting it and bring it to a point where they, you know, Russia can be the perpetual boogeyman. Like, they think, and like I said, short term, they want it to last for 10 or 20 years because they'll all be dead by then. Not, maybe not Macron. Maybe, well, who knows? But 10, 20 years, good enough. You know, they're short-term thinkers, you know, short-term materialist thinkers. Yeah. So what that means to the Russians is, like, if you're in Russia and you look at the history of, if you're in the Russian government, you look at the history, you know well the history of the rules-based international order, as it's called, quote-unquote.
Which is whatever we want today.
Which is, it's fine. Basically, it's fine. As exemplified by dozens of times when the West in general, particularly the US, but also the Brits and the French, etc., who have gone into a country and overthrown a government in order to, because it's a corrupt, evil regime that's abusing or in some way infringing the will of its people or even bombing or killing its people. That is right. Not part of international law, but it's part of the rules-based international order's rules.
Yeah,
the rules. What's one of the maybe the rule number in the rules based international order is when a people are deemed, if you can make the case that they're being persecuted by their government in some way or other, well then you're fully entitled, obligated, even under the right to protect, to go in there and take care of that government and get rid of it.
Yeah.
So
and install legally install a proper one.
So legally and morally, if you want to call it that. Right now, with this information about the will of the what the Ukrainian people want, Russia would be absolutely within its rights, and like I said, even obligated to take out the Ukrainian government, Zelensky and his people, because they are directly infringing, disregarding the will of the large majority of the Ukrainian people, and not only that, but they're killing their own people.
Mm.
As they maintain themselves in power against the will of the people and continue to pursue this war, they are actively killing large numbers of Ukrainians. So, I mean, if that was the case with America, they'd be in there like fucking white on rice, you know what I mean? It would be like a no-brainer.
When you put it that way, it's so striking the way that they've used that line over and over again for all of their various, you know, interventions in the Middle East and elsewhere. Anytime there was a whiff of anything, even though it was mostly their own farts, they were in there like swimwear and, you know, no-fly zones, bombing everything they can see. And then here, when there actually is an instance of them like directly and indirectly killing their own people.
It's supported.
It's
freedom and democracy.
It's freedom and democracy in action.
That's kind of paramoralistic, you know, conversive thinking that these people engage in. They're fucked up in the head. Like, you know, they're just liars. Like, they're massive fucking liars and hypocrites, you know? So
I think what you're hinting at though, is that this could well be Russia's.
Well, I'm just saying Russia has an opportunity. If this continues on for any length of time, Russia has an opportunity and would be within its rights and would have support, legitimate, not obviously from the European leaders and all that kind of stuff, but certainly would probably have,
precedence.
At a certain point, has precedent, but also a lot of support from the majority of the Ukrainian people. Mm-hmm. If in a short period of time, they start to realize that, look, we all want this war to end. And that fucker Zelensky is saying no. And he keeps dragging our sons off the street and throwing them into the front line. I mean, do we need to have another Maidan? How do we get rid of this guy? He's basically killing us. He's killing our sons. And specifically, there was a dump, a hack. Russian hackers, right? There's a video of one of them talking, whatever, but they reportedly breached the Ukrainian General Staff's database this past week, revealing catastrophic losses of the armed forces of Ukraine. According to the compromised digital registry, if the data is correct, Ukraine lost 1,721,000 troops, killed or missing, i.e. killed, mostly, over the 3 years of the conflict.
And it gets worse every year.
And that's a breakdown.
Wow. We're only like two-thirds of the way through this year.
Yeah. You're talking, yeah, you could get up to 1 million people this year, potentially. And throughout the war, Russia's losses have been consistently. Like, I wrote that about the losses, Russia's to Ukrainians losses were 17 times less Russians than Ukrainians. That was, I think, based on 2022 and 2023 data, you know, when, as you see, particularly in 2022, the numbers were quite small, and maybe it was that then, and maybe even in 2023. But as things got worse for the Ukrainians, as they did, as they continued to increasingly lost the war and lost manpower and lost efficiency, and especially with Trump coming in and there being a lackluster or a lack of enthusiasm, let's say, for the full-on arming Ukraine. But it really comes down to manpower. They've definitely been suffering more and more losses, which means that the ratio went up, you know. So I'd say, I mean, if it's 1,700,000 Ukrainian dead, you're probably still talking. I think latest numbers, there were never any numbers above 100,000 reported, even up to the latest numbers.
I heard in Moscow 120K.
Yeah. Right.
Estimate.
Right. As of, didn't know, as of but, now. So you're talking, that's probably a reasonable estimate, and that puts it at about 15 to 1. About 100, like about 1/15th of 1,700,000 is about 110, 115,000. Dead, which is still a lot, but you're talking about 1.7 million in Ukraine. Like,
it makes more sense, but then that, it makes sense for Russian morale in favor of the war, and it makes sense when you the hysterics in the West about Russia,
and it makes more sense with the poll, in Ukraine. Well, 70% of the people, they're all noticing it. I mean, with so many people actually left the country as well, I don't know what the actual numbers of the population are now. It's like, it used to be 40 million. It's down below probably 30 million at this point. Yeah, there's like easily 4 million in Poland or something like that, or a few million anyway in Poland and in other European countries. Others have left to other countries. So, I mean, significantly less than 40 million at this point. And then when you take, you know, upwards of 2 million, because that's just dead, usually injured, is 3 to 1. Mm. So you're talking about a few million. Maybe talking about 3-4 million injured. So you're talking up to between dead and injured, you're talking about 5 million out of in a country of maybe right now less than 30 million. You know, you're talking about 15% of the population. There's no way, like,
that's like literally every household having someone either dead or maimed.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So no wonder 70% of the population, or it's either literally everyone or literally 70% of households having someone dead or mean. And when that happens, it's like,
the thing is, though, you're right, and this is what the reckoning Ukraine is undergoing. But part of why we've been saying similar-ish things for 2 years now, going, surely they're going to rise up any day now, you know. But there's so much money being pumped in from the West that I'm seeing clips of, like, women's professional soccer televised at stadiums with sponsors and everything, and pundits being aired in at least Western Ukraine and Kiev. Life is so normal there, they still have that going.
Well, they can do that.
But the money for that is coming from the West, because it's a war of optics.
But that's that's propaganda.
So they're trying to keep everything's normal in Ukraine.
Yeah, of course, they're trying to propagandize.
And to keep them on side, of course, but it's not working because the polls show.
And the vast majority of people are aware, like, the vast majority of people are, the small area of Western Ukraine that is relatively untouched by this is. But even them, they're not, because a lot of people are being mobilized from there as well. And I think maybe it's getting to the point where the mobilization is taking place across the entire country, as they're have less and less people to actually man the weapons type thing.
They're having to drill into their
Reserves.
Their European Ukrainian.
Yeah.
Yesterday was Independence Day in Ukraine. Independence from what? Who never knows? Because they're certainly not independent today. Statements from Zelensky, who gave a TV address. I know. But now, in the context of what we just heard, Ukrainians are listening to that, and the vast majority of them are thinking, fuck you. Quote, Ukraine will never again in history be forced into the shame that Russians call compromise. Another quote, Ukraine has restored unity between Europe and the U.S., this is where I think he, like, he thinks him and Hillary and von der Leyen are solid, you know. Ukraine has restored unity between Europe and the US and is now the foundation of this alliance. Ukraine is not asking, it is offering alliance and partnership, the best army in Europe, advanced defense technologies, experience of resilience.
And just people know, just people know about those numbers, you'll see in the West, the British MOD and all this kind of stuff are putting out numbers, and they're putting out numbers that are basically inverted. Mm. And they're not exactly inverted, but they're putting out like Russia's lost 1 million men. The Ukrainians are somewhere around like 300,000 or 200,000 or 300,000 or something. So they have it not turned around on its head, but like massively
distorted
in the opposite direction. And of course, you expect that. Anybody who reads those numbers and doesn't look at the bigger picture, you know, and look at the way the war's been processed and how Russia continues on and how the Ukrainians are, you know, having to drag people off the streets and how they're being supported massively by the West and all this kind of stuff. And just even from a military perspective, all you have to do is look at the relative difference in the actual military power of the two countries. I mean, if you paid any attention at all, you would know for sure that whatever the numbers are, it's not more Russians than Ukrainians. It's way more Ukrainians than Russians. That's just a rational blink that any normal person would take, except for the fact that outlets like the UK Telegraph and stuff and BBC or whoever else are reporting the MOD. And they think the MOD like is front and centre in processing this war in Ukraine. Are not going to release propaganda in their favor. It's just like,
yeah,
people are clueless. Like, whatever, dude, it's just like a retard.
It's
can't help it.
It's an extraordinary war because, I mean, the conventional doctrine is that any invading force, if it wants to do anything in another place that's not their place, needs a minimum 3-to-1
mm-hmm.
force to do anything.
Right, and they didn't have that.
It's quite the opposite is what took place in Ukraine. So then you listen to the skeptics going, oh, look how it's taken 4 years or whatever for Russia to grind a few inches here, a few yeah. inches there. But they're still thinking conventional terms that Putin is trying to sweep across Ukraine and mm-hmm. take it all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, you dipshits. It's really obvious at this point that it's taking place in a functional way. It could be anywhere in Ukraine, for that matter. It happens to be in a densely ethnic Russian place, but it's carefully, like you said, it responds to political, to international issues, to political sentiments inside Ukraine, what's happening politically in Kiev with Zelensky and Zelensky mm-hmm. and oh, there's factions. And it's intense here and then it's not. And then there's a breach and they let them have their counterattack and, you know, in Kursk and stuff. And then that's dealt with slowly, methodically, not, you know, crazily. It's also methodical. And if our scenario is in any way the actual one that is massively reversed in Russia's favor, the invaders' favor, then there's no historical comparison.
All people have is the First or Second World War.
Yeah, they think it's French warfare.
They think because it's Europe, then it's like the Second World War, because that was the last time you had a war in Europe, right? So it must be like Second World War, where you just like, you know, you had meat grinders, and you use all these terms, meat grinders and throwing troops at artillery and all that kind of stuff. That obviously wasn't the case from day one. Anybody who's been watching this war and how it was being pursued from day one by Putin, it was obviously designed to minimize Ukrainian civilian casualties and most importantly, maybe to minimize Russian military losses. Putin was like, we're not like throwing people at this. We're going to go as slowly and methodically, like you said, as we can. And it's going to be a war of attrition.
All right,
we have very clear goals. We want these four regions in the east and we're going to secure those four regions, and we're going to take however long it takes to get those four regions, but we're going to minimize casualties on our side and maximize casualties on our side. We're going to attrite their forces down to nothing.
While minimizing civilian casualties on their side. Of course. I mean, that's a first. There is no 20th century comparison for
but
that.
They can't, people can't believe that because
it sounds fanciful.
Well, no, because Putin's a dictator.
But he convinced himself that Putin's an evil dictator, Hitler,
and he would just slaughter people.
Actually, it's a completely novel phenomenon. There is no fucking precedent.
Well, there probably is in history. I mean, there's been a lot of war throughout history where someone's gone about it in that way, but
it's almost the way that it's been.
It's almost like a guerrilla war on a state level.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually a really good comparison for it. Because it's like all the strategy that Russia has taken so far is playing to its strengths. Because it knows that.
And sit back. I mean,
it doesn't have to. Not only does it not have to go no holds barred, throw everything we got all at once. Not only does it not have to do that, it would be in. It's not in its interest to do that.
Absolutely not.
Because then they can't use the optics of how they've been doing it to continue doing it. It would, in fact, draw all of the countries in directly, which then would screw them.
Yes, and they can't have they had to be very careful about the amount of casualties that they're taking on the Russian side for public opinion back home.
Exactly,
because you know if there's say 100,000 Russian dead, then that's 100,000 families who have lost a family member, and that's quite a lot, but it's still very small compared to the total population of Russia. If it was much more than that, if you're talking into the millions stuff, you would get to the point where you would have public sentiment would spread kind of organically in a weird kind of mass consciousness kind of way. And it would be turn against the war. It would be much more difficult to get to have so much support for the war that there clearly still is in Russia, and people are okay with it, and people seem and the government itself is happy to continue. The opposite's happening in Ukraine, as an example of this poll, and if they push it further, they're going to get to the point where there'll be public, there already has been public protests.
Oh yeah, yeah, there's been a number of them.
And they'll get worse. And the only way they can keep that under wraps is by suppression and dissent and controlling the information that gets out there, you know, but internally it's not going anywhere. And just to get back to what we're saying about Russia having the legal, quasi-legal, let's say, as per the rules-based international order, legal right, authority, and even moral obligation to do something about this illegitimate regime in Kiev that is killing its own people and thumbing its nose at the wishes, the democratic wishes of the Ukrainian people. Lukashenko reported. He basically reported that this week. He said it on camera, I think, that he had been talking to some. He was in Moscow and he'd been talking to some of the people in the government and stuff. And he said that there's a group of hardliners around Putin who are demanding that Putin just cut this shit out and take out the decision-making centers. That's the term they use, right? That means the government, the decision-making centers in Kiev, i.e. the government, Zelensky et al., and anybody else who's hanging around him. And just because now is the time to do it. And Lukashenko said that Putin's response to that was absolutely not. And why not? He said, because there'd be nothing left of Kiev if we were to use
such
because
a weapon.
The suggestion was to use Oreshnik. That's what these hardliners are saying. Use Oreshnik and take out the decision-making centers, i.e. the Ukrainian government, and Zelensky, get rid of him and allow, create a space for the will of the Ukrainian people to express itself, because it's being blocked now by these people, Zelensky et al. And his friends in Europe. But I think, I mean, I'm not saying it was deliberately done that way, but it's interesting that he put it out there, because I think, because like we've been saying, now and in the near future, the time actually is very ripe for that kind of thing to happen. Like, these hardliners are not really hardliners, let's say, you know. If you're a fly on the wall, let's say, if there is some kind of attempted subterfuge going on here, it's an attempt to lull the Ukrainians and the Europeans into a false sense of security that Putin is such a peacenik. Because you have to remember, the way we describe peace process in this war, they all know that. The propaganda that we're getting that that Putin's lost millions of men and that he's killing all these civilians and he's a brutal Hitler-like warmonger who's just throwing men into a meat grinder and killing civilians all over the place.
They know
They know that's not true. And they know that he's processed this war in a very careful, calculated way in order to avoid civilian casualties and to avoid deaths among the Russian soldiers and stuff. And they're a bit puzzled by it in a certain sense, but I suppose they recognize that that's what's going on. So they see him, like you said, as a peacenik, essentially, that he's a bit timid. He's definitely been very timid in this conflict, you know.
Which has only increased Kiev and the Euro's rhetoric and bravado.
Yeah, that's exactly. What they think. Keep going. And the Americans as well.
Before that's Trump. Why they see no risk with...
Right.
What are you talking about, Trump? You don't need peace
Trump's not going to use nuclear weapons. That's all nonsense. He's such a peacenik. He'll never do that. Yeah. And he would never take out Zelensky. Like, I mean, he had plenty of opportunities to try and do that.
Yeah, he hasn't done it.
And so he talks it up like, you know, watch out, accusing threatening the British, saying, you know, UK is only so many, well, mainly through Medvedev, actually.
Yes.
Is only a few minutes or whatever, 10 minutes from...
Medvedev is
missiles
alter
could be,
ego.
Yeah. Our missiles can be in London in 10 minutes, so watch out what you say and blah, 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 blah. But they know Medvedev, just the mad dog, whatever, and Putin behind the scenes is like, look...
Dima,
calm down. We're not doing that.
Don't post that.
This isn't where this is going, Dima. Don't be so belligerent. We want our security interests respected. We want some security. We're peaceful people. We just want some security. And the more he's acted like that, I mean, he can say that, but as long as he has continued to act like that over the past 3.5 years, the Europeans, despite their mistrust and, you know, suspicious minds and that kind of stuff, they start to believe that he actually is like that. So you take that to a point where it's locked in. They really think that Putin is not the kind of person who's going to take some kind of a
decapitation,
a shocking aggressive action like that and have Lukashenko repeat it, just to put it out there. Maybe even just within a few weeks or a few months of him actually doing it. Because, like I said, the time is right, especially with... Because, I mean...
Well, he's got an ally in Trump now.
Yeah.
It could be interpreted that way.
Yeah. I mean,
he kind of needed Trump. Okay.
But I think it would have happened anyway. If it's going to happen, it would have happened anyway. Reznik's would eventually be used on Kiev. Putin has not done that because he's been respecting the will of... You could argue that, I don't know if it's true or not, but has not taken out Zelensky at all in Kiev.
Because it could be breaching free will.
Effectively, he's respecting the will of the Ukrainian people to support Zelensky in defending their country against Russia's invasion. But as soon as they turn around and say, no, we want this to end... He's like, well,
I did it for Ukrainians.
I mean, they've just started to attack those territory or the recruitment centers, you know, because they got the impression from different sources of information, etc., that ordinary Ukrainians were very unhappy about that, about their sons and fathers, etc., being abducted off the streets and thrown into the war. So whenever they started... Because it's only in the past couple of months that they actually started targeting their centers. They could have done it before, but they only started recently because they got information that this was something that would actually be popular among the Ukrainian people. So if at this point, if this continues on, I think it will, and Zelensky becomes more less and less popular amongst the Ukrainian people, well then Russia will be like, well, the door's open to get rid of him.
Okay, and we'll then there's a disarray. Vacuum, or maybe Russia's prepared something to fill put their guy in, do a reverse Maidan.
I think we'll have to have a
closure on 2014.
I think we'll have to have some kind of a Maidan. There might be some fallout from that, from if you got rid of took out the Zelensky government, basically get rid of Zelensky and all the people around him. They're no longer there. They've been Reshniked. Then there will be an opportunity. If Russia...
London, Paris, and Berlin will go ballistic because they Russia need Zelensky
I know,
there.
But they can do nothing about it.
Yeah.
And if that vacuum of power, if Russia has the capabilities, I don't know if they do or not, to actually, you know, start some kind of a...
Mass media.
A groundswell, grassroots...
Color revolution.
Kind of a revolution, but in order to... to not allow the Europeans to sweep in and just stick some Zelensky part two in power and keep things going.
Which may be the urgency for that, why they want Euro troops. Maybe they're, it seems dumb on the surface, cause like, dude, you're not going to take on Russia. They know that, but they're going to put Euro troops close to Kiev as possible.
To control the
as,
people.
As a, because they've assessed that Putin is a peacenik pussy. So let's put Euro troops there. He won't strike them. And they'll act as a kind of a, almost like human shields to prop up and sustain the Zelensky regime.
Yeah, against the Ukrainians. That may be against the Ukrainian people. They want. Yeah. Not against Russians, against Ukrainians.
Troops to be like an
enforcer, a European enforcing European policy on a new Ukraine post Zelensky, which is we get another Zelensky and fuck the will of the Ukrainian people.
Yes, but
someone who will continue.
Do you know
to,
what? Functionally the enforcer for Kiev has been the Nazi cadres.
Yeah, the Azov.
You notice those shitheads are still marching all over like Odessa and places. Yeah. Why have they not died at the front yet? Because they don't recruit them. They keep them. No, they're
the home guard.
Terrorizing.
They're the home guard.
Everyone else in Ukraine.
They're always helping the home guard to keep Ukraine Nazi, basically. Keep it extremist, extreme right.
To keep the minority. Extreme right wing. To keep the minority in power that the CIA put in there in 2014.
Right. Well, before that.
It's funny, you know, Zelensky was elected with around 70% in 2019 on the mandate of ending the war against the Donbass. And that figure has cropped up again. But this time, at least back then, it would have included people in the four regions, or at least two of the other ones. Now it's 70% excluding the four regions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Did you see Salvini mocking Macron's Euro army?
Mm. Tell him to just put on a helmet and go over there himself.
And Macron, he pulled up the Italian ambassador.
Why are he saying bad things to me?
Signori.
Explain. This is not very right. This is not very correct. You cannot say bad things about me.
The Elise pulled up Italy's ambassador for the insult because the French foreign ministry said the ambassador for Italy was reminded that these remarks went against the climate of trust and historical relationship between our two countries. It's all of a piece. Like the Euro elites in European capitals absolutely depend on each other and Zelensky over there because that's their base. They must support each other. If one falls, you know, they're all done for.
It's that big five, you know. Brits, along with the European, von der Reich Gaultier von der Leyen of Europe, and the Brits, Germans, the French.
Zelensky has no Italians. He has no idea. Did you see his quip when he was talking with Trump in the Oval Office? It went very different to last time. He was talking about, defending Ukraine, blah, blah. He was doing his thing. But at the point where he said something about, this is why we have no elections, Trump interrupted him and said, to get a clarification. So in a state of war, you can postpone the elections. Oh, that's something to think about for 2028 or something like that. And Zelensky, just enjoying the camaraderie, says, you like that, eh? Isn't it funny?
But then he went,
and then Ukrainians are going to hear that.
Yeah. Well, I really wasn't being serious. I think it'll come to an end relatively soon because those numbers are unsustainable. And I think they're jostling now for, like we were saying, a kind of post-Zelensky. They'd like to keep Zelensky in power or at least have some kind of transition where it's handed off to some Zelensky part two type thing. And I think that's something that'll be an opportunity ripe for the Russians to throw a spanner in the works there, throw a monkey wrench in the works of that, you know, stopping that, the attempt to continue on this fascist kind of regime in Ukraine. They want to put an end to that, basically. Yeah. And the only way they can really do that is to really take them all out in some kind of a strike. And then hopefully, maybe if they can, like I said, have people in the country, their own operatives in the country, have a reverse Maidan.
Or at least try to kick one off. Of some
yeah.
kind.
Yeah, but get the people in the streets, basically, you know?
Yeah.
So that they can actually, you know, have an end to the conflict and not see it as being something that's going to be kept on the back burner, kept boiling over for the foreseeable future. Like, I'm sure the Ukrainian people don't want this to go on for another 10 years. Like, who would? You get tired, you know? And the Americans, they're, I suppose, happy to, under Trump, I suppose they're happy to, at least Trump is happy, would be happy enough to see that that happen. I'm not saying you'd get some kind of a Russian, a pro-Russian necessarily, but you'd get somebody who's kind of moderate or whatever. It'll all have to work itself out over a number of years, like, as well. Ukraine is going to have to be reformed over a number of years into something, you know, something. Ideally, and the Russians, that will have to be just watched as it plays out, you know. It's not like Zelensky's gone, you put in a pro-Russian government, and then everybody's happy. Europeans go away, everyone's happy. From one day to the next, it's indisputable that if tomorrow a bunch of Reznyaks are fired and take out the entire Ukrainian government and the House of Parliament and everybody in it, it's going to be presented as, on every broadsheet yeah. for days, evil Putin destroys the Ukrainian government, you know, assassinates all members of the Ukrainian government, and it'll be like, he'll be like, Putin killed my baby. It'll be worse than ever.
Yeah.
You know, that in itself isn't a loss for them. They haven't lost anything at that point. The only place where they might actually lose is down the line, that what happens afterwards, and then they would immediately go into, and probably have plans for it, they would immediately go into the process of trying to get cobble together a new Ukrainian government with just a successor to Zelensky, that was of like mind and would continue to say evil Russia, and we want to be part of NATO, we want to be part of Europe, we need to keep, you know, we need Europe support and America support to keep fighting against, look what they've just done, horror of horrors. But the question I was bringing up way back at the beginning before we started all this was whether or not the Ukrainian people would intercede at that point, and whether or not the Russians would have something in place to try and kickstart some kind of a popular grassroots revolution to stop that from happening, to stop the Europeans and the Americans, the deep state, whatever, from just shunting in a new cabal of Azov types into the Ukrainian government and then carry on as if nothing happened.
Mm.
And if the Ukrainian people say, no fucking way, this was our opportunity. A lot of us are actually not that unhappy that Zelensky is gone and the rest of them.
Mm.
And we want this to be an end to the war. And here you are trying to, with your European friends, trying to shunt in a replacement for him to keep it going. And if at that point they have some kind of an obviously internal kind of uprising or some kind of a protest, mass protest in the street to try and stop that from happening. And obviously it gets very complicated at that point, and there's a process that it would follow, maybe a civil war, who knows what will come out of it. But for me, all of that's internal to Ukraine. And totally disconnected from anything happening in Europe. And there's nothing in that would set a fire in the minds of French people to suddenly all rise up against the French government. Because I don't see any connection between them at all, you know. That's its own isolated thing. If there's something going to happen in Europe, that you can look at each different European country and see how that might actually play out, but it would be to do with internal issues. I'm not saying they're not connected to the whole globalist bullshit and sending weapons to Ukraine and money to Ukraine and all that kind of stuff, but right now that's not what people haven't fixated on that, you know. Like I said, in the UK, the people, the furor or the upset about people being arrested for painting George's crosses on different places has nothing to do with sending money to Ukraine or supporting Ukraine. That's Starmer, the radical fascist lefty trying to shit on our heritage and bring in a bunch of migrants. There is no word, the word Ukraine isn't mentioned in any of that, you know, in terms of people's minds. Because it's obviously as egregious, ridiculous, like that the actual government would be. It's very similar to to them criminalizing Palestine action, you know, anybody carrying a Palestinian flag or with a t-shirt saying Palestine action or something like that is immediately arrested and taken to the police station.
Have you seen the troll on that?
Yeah, Plasticine Action.
Plasticine Action.
Yeah. That's a good way to do it as well, Plasticine Action. It looks exactly like it, but, you know, they don't want the... What is it about?
Cops are stopping them with AI. A t-shirt that looks like it says Palestine Action, but... Yeah. And the mind is tricked, but then you read it. Oh no, it's Plasticine, they're on the phone to their bosses. We're not sure how to proceed here because it looks like their intent is to infringe the law on this now.
Because Palestine Action is a prescribed terrorist group, effectively.
And the cops are like, "We'll let you go," but yeah,
Plasticine Action is basically their. I mean, it's obviously. It's a setup, like it's fake. They're actually pro-Palestine supporters or pro-Palestine, but they there's a way around it because it looks like Palestine Action, but it says Plasticine Action, and they claim that they've got a little picture of Morphe's little stop-action figure from the 80s, whatever, and they're campaigning against the use of AI in stop-action animation that they need to go back to because you're taking jobs away from people, so... We need to use normal people, real people, to do this. So that's their kind of setup, if you know what I mean, their narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But it's similar, like I was saying, to criminalize people supporting Palestine as criminalizing people flying or painting an English flag because it's kind of ridiculous. You know, people supporting Palestine are basically just supporting, saying there shouldn't be any more killing of children. So, oh, that's a crime. And people, it's in the same vein as people saying, you know, I like England because I'm an English person. We should have more English things.
You're like, well, you're in England, therefore, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. You know, I mean, of course, there's a subtext of, in both of them, in the pro-Palestine one, there's a subtext of anti-Israel sentiment, anti-Zionist sentiment, and the pro-English, you know, painting English flags, there's a subtext of no more immigration.
Mm-hmm.
But we can argue, well, you can't really argue against those two things either. But the government then criminalizes that aspect of it, right?
Yeah.
One is an anti-Semitism and the other one is racist, which is more or less the same thing, even though they're not, neither of them. So, this was, speaking about Israel, do you remember your guy, Count Dracula?
Count Dracula?
No, in the White House. The White House, was he the Pentagon deputy spokesman?
Miller,
yeah. He was on... it was really Channel 13. And he's actually said something since he left the Biden administration, since the Biden administration ended and he didn't have a job anymore. He's also come out in the past, you know, earlier this year, saying things that are like, whoa, never expected you inveterate fucking liar. Mm-hmm. I never expected you to say anything truthful, you know. But he said something else. I can't remember what it was about, but he said something quite truthful. I think it was related to Israel as well, but he said something on Israeli Channel 13 recently as well. We can have a listen to it here.
Oh, did he?
I didn't get a link.
You didn't?
Oh.
It's consistent with the pattern we saw for many months. They were always looking for ways to add conditions or make the terms more difficult.
האמריקנים עוד עושים מאמץ חצי נואש להגיע לפשרה. מתארגן מפגש ביטחוני במצרים.
It's really our best chance to get a deal. And Hamas, for the first time, really was feeling pressure to agree.
הייתה מפה שאומרת, זה המינימום שצהל יודע לחיות איתו. בגדול... סביב טנצ'ר מעבר רפיח למשך 42 יום.
כלומר, פינוי הרוב המוחלט של ציר פילדלפי
נשארות
רק סביב מעבר רפיח.
המפה הזאת לא קיבלה אישור להיות מוצגת, בעניין נתקע. שהקבינט, חוץ ממני, מצביע בעד ההישארות בפילדלפי ל-42 היום נוספים.
We were really close to a deal, and the prime minister added these new conditions around the Philadelphia corridor and around Netzarim.
Anyway, there was more. You need to have been a Yiddish speaker to get all of that, because your other guy, former defense minister, he's basically saying the same thing, that every time Israel, or every time the Americans, even under Biden, got close talks with Hamas, etc., and Qataris and all that kind of stuff, to get a deal to stop the Israeli bombing and killing in Gaza, the Israelis would immediately
change the goalposts,
add new conditions, and then there'll be no deal. Which is not surprising, but it's interesting to hear. You know, the fact of the matter is they all knew it. The Americans have known that a long time. So, and what they've known is that the Israelis have been intent on dealing with Gaza and the Palestinians in Gaza and in the West Bank as part of a long-term plan. They've been this business since October 7th is part of that, and that they've never been serious about any kind of agreement. They've been, in fact, their biggest fear was that they would be forced into some kind of agreement that would force them to stop the war and the bombing of Gaza, because they're kind of like, look, don't you realize, like, this is, we're not really serious about the hostages, we're not really serious about saving them, we don't care about them, in fact we're using them to justify bombing everybody, and we don't want to deal with Hamas, we want to kill them all. What part of that aren't you getting? I mean, have we not been bloodthirsty enough to make it clear that we just want to wipe, hello? And have you not read about history to know what we're all about? What's Zionist? Like, you know, greater Israel, you know, like making Israel safe, destroying the axis of evil, like, you know, starting with the Palestinians, then the Lebanon and Hezbollah, then Syria, Assad, then Iran, you know. So it's like anybody going along going.
But this guy saying this retrospectively, you know, as if he's being honest now, it's sickening, because at every single step along the way, the slightest criticism of Israel, he was actively defending, even though he's just emerged from a meeting, say, where he's learned that they have gone and changed the goalposts again. His either instinctive or his well-trained or his politically agreed instinct, as he walks in the corridor from where he's just been told the goalposts have been shifted again, to going, good morning, press, is what's going on in his head is, okay, I have to keep going. I have to, mm-hmm. How am I going to spin this well for Israel? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't get to go afterwards. Okay, I'm out now. Hi, honesty time.
Yeah.
Well, he's
an active participant in the genocide.
Well,
he should be hung like the rest of them.
Well, apparently
international law.
Yeah.
We don't have time this week. I really wanted to, but something's going on with Intel and chips. Maybe next week. It's ongoing. Howard Lutnick proudly boasted on X yesterday, that's Trump's commerce secretary, that the U.S. government now owns 10% of Intel, the number one or two chip manufacturer. It's bizarre that there's something. So here's an outline of the deal in the Guardians. It's a write up of it. It's not alone. This is the most high profile version of what's happened recently. But as the first few paragraphs here make clear, this has been happening. This is happening to multiple high tech U.S. companies. Trump says Intel has agreed to give U.S. government a 10% stake. That makes it sound like it's becoming a public company. It's not quite like that. Unprecedented deal comes after president demanded CEO Lip-Bu Tan to resign over his ties to Chinese firms. So that's probably how they strong-armed it into happening. The USG has taken a stake in Intel under a deal with a struggling chipmaker, okay, and is planning more such moves. Luttig announced this on X yesterday. Trump met with Tan on Friday. The way Trump announced it, he walked in, wanted to keep his job, and he ended up giving us $10 billion for the United States. While Trump did not provide detail, the equity stake is about equal to the amount Intel is set to receive in grants from the government under the Chips and Science Act to help fund the building of chip plants in the U.S. This Intel investment will be the latest of several unusual deals struck by the Trump admin with U.S. companies, including agreeing to allow NVIDIA to sell its H2O or H20 chips to China in exchange for the U.S. government receiving 15% of those sales. Chipmaker AMD struck a similar deal.
That was the one I was thinking of, AMD and NVIDIA, given 15% of those sales.
So on the face of it, it's like you were saying to me, this is a workaround compromise, so these guys don't skip paying tariffs.
Because it's cheaper, maybe.
But doesn't it also sound like if this is trying to bring manufacturing bases home? Any multipolar world, having it far-flung over there is dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. That's what Trump wants. Like, he's talking about all the time, about them onshoring their operations.
I can't separate it from this news, though. This is a month old, about Intel. I think their stocks absolutely tank after this. Literally 1 month ago, Intel is laying off 24,000 employees and retreating from some companies, namely Germany and Costa Rica. So to give you an idea, Intel employed 109,800 people at the end of last year. Pushing out 24,000 people this year shrinks its employee base by one quarter. Scotty, what do you think? Are they sucking in part because they're losing to China already? I mean, if I look this up officially, the U.S. still dominates like 90% of the market for chips.
Yeah,
that is still the case. So how can they be hemorrhaging staff? Why are they wanting to downsize by a quarter? Any ideas?
It's kind of complicated because basically Intel has been sucking for years. So their processors, beginning with like the 10th generation, were not so good. Now they're on 15th generation. So each iteration was kind of evolutionary instead of revolutionary. And then AMD picked up competition, blah, blah, blah. Intel's processors haven't been very good, so they started off with basically Intel struggling. After decades of being the dominant chip maker, like, they made bad decisions. They had problems with their lithography, their designs, and their different nodes, the lithography nodes, 7 nanometer, 10 nanometer, whatever. Now they're down to, like, they're actually using TSMC to manufacture their newest processors. So they have actually a lot of problems in making. As a company, they're in trouble. And so they laid off people. They brought in the new CEO. The idea that they're going to actually manufacture chips on U.S. soil, that's already fallen flat on its face, because they invested like billions in some place in, I think, a couple different places. One of them was supposed to be like Ohio or Texas, or I don't remember where. But they started building the plant, and then just like a couple months ago, there was a news story that, they started like, they built the place and they started moving equipment in, and then they went, oh, shoot. Yeah, we have to actually scrap all this equipment because the technology has advanced, so now we need new lithography machines. So this is probably not going to work. And that's when they went with TSMC, the Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturer, the big one. So it's all kind of a mess. And like, it's the same thing with Trump wanting to build the iPhone in the US. Like, it'll take 10 years to get everything up and running. And even if you have the manufacturing capacity, what about the raw materials? You need to get those mostly from China. So I don't know what the point of taking a 10% stake in Intel. Now, they also said the other day, yeah, the U.S. government's going to take a 10% stake in, like, Samsung. And, I mean, that's like a South Korean company. It's like, I mean, I know they want to get their mitts on it and be like, yeah, we control you now. But, like, that's not how it works. So...
Maybe it's like Joe suggested. They're calling this, they're happy for the headlines in the business press to say it's a 10% stake, because it suggests, like, too big to fail. You have unlimited U.S. government backing. You have the mighty imprimatur of the U.S. Treasury stamped. Right. This product is approved by Donald Trump. Whereas, in fact, all it is sneaky workarounds for how to balance up the grants they get, like we saw under the CHIPS Act, with the goddamn tariffs they're meant to pay as largely foreign companies.
It sounds to me like Trump's just treating the whole thing like a business. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean? He's treating the U.S. government like a business. So if the U.S. government and the U.S. country, USA is a business, then it should have stakes like any other business should invest its money in companies. And of course, there's a leverage they can have over the company because they have a 10% stake. And also maybe they can bail it out, whatever, different ways they can support that company. But like Samsung is a South Korean company, taking a 10% stake in that is like me taking a 10% stake in it. It's just I've been buying some shares, like, unless there's something else, but it's just like making money. Samsung looks good, I'm gonna get me 10% of Samsung and sell it for twice the amount. I don't know, maybe that's how crass Trump is, where he's just like he's just being literally a businessman, using
the U.S. Treasury.
Using the U.S. Treasury to
invest in some stocks. Which is
what they kind of do that anyway. You know, they get other countries to invest in them, you know, by buying bonds and stuff. So, I don't know, maybe he's got some new ideas about how to run the whole place, you know. Make America wealthy again. But, yeah.
Some good news this week. Ghislaine Maxwell, we now know, she told U.S. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, it's okay, there is no list. Case
no
closed.
List at all.
There is no list that I'm aware of.
That's going to get her out of
there. Is no list, and Bill Clinton never got a massage, and Trump was never did anything untoward with anyone ever.
But she also said, I do not believe he died by suicide. So are you saying someone was killed? No, she's not. She dismissed that too, because she said,
"If it was murder, it was internal." Which made it, which
he the, said, if, the way if someone wanted to kill him, they had plenty of opportunity to do it before. Why do it in prison?
Yeah,
which is a smart point, because what she's saying is that leaves the most logical conclusion is he's alive. He was exfiltrated from that prison.
Mm-hmm. She, can you open that one, Scotty? Prince Andrew's wife, Sarah Ferguson, known as Sarah Ferguson now, used to be the Duchess of something or other. She tried to put the moves on Epstein, according to, this again, Ghislaine Maxwell. Says that Sarah Ferguson encouraged the friendship between Jeffrey Epstein and Prince Andrew. And the first line is, Sarah Duchess of York, she used to be called, yet, tried to put the moves on Jeffrey Epstein. What a sordid bunch.
Oh, yeah.
It's totally. The gang, the people they associate with.
Totally.
The cliques. But the interesting thing, I had an interesting kind of thought there during the week, because I think I was watching something. I was watching actually a video of a guy who was on the west coast of Ireland near Sligo, and he was pointing out some of the scenery on the coast, and he pointed out a castle something or other, which was, he mentioned was, what do you call them? I've forgotten his name now.
Where Mountbatten was?
Lord Mountbatten. Lord Mountbatten's family kind of holiday home on the Sligo coast from that he spent his summers at. And this was Lord Mountbatten, was the Queen Elizabeth II's cousin. and a big name in the royal family, World War II hero and all that kind of stuff. And he used to spend time on in Ireland, as Ireland being a, you know, during his era anyway, being a part of the empire, he had a holiday home there and he would go, had a boat and he would take his boat out. But it was since, and he was actually killed when the IRA put a bomb in his boat in 1979 and blew it up with him in it. Kind of like just underlining the statement, you know, Brits go home. But it came out after that in recent years, including evidence from an FBI file on him that he was actually a paedophile. So no loss there for anyone. But Prince Andrew spent a lot of time with him at his various holiday homes when he was a child.
Mm-hmm.
And then Prince Andrew ends up having a penchant as an adult for underage girls, at the very least.
Yeah.
So, nice legacy there from this great uncle, Bertie, or whatever his name was. Probably, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know how that thing works, you know. Anyway, those royals and all those people.
Parallel universe.
Yeah, a dirty, a nasty one. Anyway.
Are we good?
What have you got?
A need for...
Anything from the Mago files?
I've got a need for some...
Speed.
Jokes.
You do? Why? Have you got one?
No.
Why not? I've got a need for some jokes?
Yeah. I'm just, you've trained me. You've trained me to expect one.
I've trained you like a monkey.
I learned it from you.
I asked my 8-year-old nephew what he learned at school the other day. And he said, apparently not enough because I have to go back tomorrow.
A smart kid.
It's a sharp one.
School. Did you like going to school?
Sort of, not mixed. Really. Yeah, it was a mixed bag. I remember staring out the window a lot, wishing I was one of those birds floating around.
Yeah, I didn't. I was always promised, don't worry, the next bigger school you go to, like secondary school,
that'll be better.
University, it'll be more challenging and more stimulating for you. And I got to university and I was like, this is a load of nonsense. Because 9/11 had just happened.
Oh, yeah.
And they were doing politics. And like the elephant in the room is like, obviously 9/11, war on terror. Now we're invading Iraq. And everyone's just studiously avoiding it. Mm-hmm. This is insane. These are the intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they do now. I mean, by 2006, some postgrads were approving works on neocons, the PNAC.
Yeah.
But there was 4 or 5 years there of just terror. You just, PNAC, do not, no, you can't submit that. No.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of incipient realization that you were encroaching on the J topic. And, oh, right. Put it away. So, yeah.
Avoid.
Fundamentally dishonest, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Still plenty of those around.
This is probably going to keep going, but Venezuela. U.S. warships off Venezuela.
Arashniks in Venezuela.
No way.
Who said that? Maybe one day. They're just floating it to...
Yeah.
Just jerking the Americans' chains.
This thing about Maduro and the $50 million bounty, I mean... Is Trump seriously going to... Because he got egg on his face when that one Guaido coup failed so badly last time in his first term. I thought it was interesting, though, that the headlines were full of, wow, U.S. warships sent to fight drug cartels. And everyone's going, oh, my God. It's really about the oil, by the way. But then the next day, that sort of just sequentially, they're not directly connected. The FBI raids John, I once cooed Venezuela, Walton's house at a 6 a.m. dawn raid. That was the sequential. This just happened the next day, but because Bolton went on CNN and said, yeah, I was involved in that coup right. a few years ago. And then, again, it's separate, but Tulsi Gabbard stripped security clearances from 37 current and former intel officials on the basis that they were manipulating, politicizing intelligence. She also announced in declaring that she had done this, that, quote, this is the first step to aggressively get after our core national security mission and root out these deep state actors.
Good luck.
Separately, the next day, Hegseth, the media headline was purge. It's just three figures, but Hegseth fired key people in the Pentagon, including the head of the DIA, who they fingered for having released what Trump called the fake news of the report about the U.S. strikes against
which was probably true
in Iran. Right. But it was the leaking of it.
Not allowed to leak it. It means you're an anti-Trumper.
So we're draining the swamp.
Woo! It's happening.
It's happening, Adam.
Your dream's coming true, Adam.
I can't believe it. I'm so happy.
But you're not, because you wanted, at this point, you wanted tribunals and...
Oh, I wanted so much.
You wanted them all lined up.
Yeah.
But you do get to see John Bolton's house raid at 6 a.m.
And that did make me smile.
Okay.
I'm not going to lie. I was smirking.
I think it's a feint. I mean, there is obviously a drug issue, but Venezuela isn't the drug issue. So that's just a fig leaf. Venezuela's value to the U.S. is the oil reserves, because Venezuela's oil is and always currently still is geared towards being refined at Louisiana oil refineries. So Trump is trying to get that plugged back in. He's posting threats about how we'll regime change you to make it happen. But in reality, like in the first week, he sent Grinnell, the gay former diplomat, ambassador to Germany, to arrange the return of U.S. Special Forces who've been arrested and imprisoned for plotting the 2018 assassination of Maduro. And they were all like, chummy, chummy. It was great. We're on good terms with Maduro. That was in week one in January this year. And then 7 months, and suddenly there's a bounty of $50 million on Maduro's head. And you're like, oh my God, Trump's flipped again. He's got warships outside Caracas. Mm-hmm. He's about to win weapons hot. And the next news development is John Bolton's been raided, you know. It's so Trumpian, because you're like, it looks like it's this. Oh, something totally different, you know. And so it goes. We're going to have to spend 4 years now doing this, because it's like the hot takes on Twitter will be old by that evening, because the reverse of what it looked like has just happened.
Yeah. Probably going to go in that direction increasingly. Yeah. I accidentally used some dog shampoo today.
Yeah.
I'm feeling like such a good boy. There you go.
Woof.
Woof.
Woof, woof. So there you go.
My shirt's from Russia. Sorry, I can't tell you where.
And you can't tell them what it means either.
Not verbatim, but the gist of it, yeah. I think it's Lavrov saying, it's from that quote where he says back to a journalist, what, you don't speak Russian? Maybe it's time to learn. Something like that.
Mm. And it says Russian special language at the top.
In English?
Mm.
Okay.
Russian special language. Definitely special. Is. It definitely is.
Definitely special.
Special. All right. So we'll, I'm going to leave it there for this week, folks. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for watching, commenting, And don't forget, like and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another one. So until then, have a good week. See ya.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.
Can't stop the signal now.